Lincoln, Lincoln, they call it. Poor, sainted, martyred Abe. The last time we were this divided, the blue against the gray, he gave his life to heal us, and we thought we were healed. But the gray has risen again, bathed in its old blood. Now it's the red against the blue, and Lincoln is just an ugly street. Our car blew some kind of pump a couple of days ago, and now I'm walking to the mechanic shop to pick it up. In shirt sleeves, because it's 80 degrees on this November evening. But hey, global warming is a Chinese hoax, so not to worry. Cars have their windows rolled down, and as I walk past a clot of them backed up at a traffic light, I see a red Mustang, driven by a buff young Hispanic guy in buzzed hair and white T-shirt, a rap tune pounding from his sound system. Fuck Donald Trump! Yeah, yeah, fuck Donald Trump! I give him the clenched fist power salute, and he salutes back. In 1997, Ram Dass was working on a book about conscious aging. The first draft came back from his editor with a note saying it was too glib, too superficial. That night, as he lay in bed wondering how to connect more intimately with the anguish of aging, he had a debilitating stroke. Talk about on the nose. This is my stroke. This is my plunge into fear. Fear that the good times are over, that chaos is unleashed, that my children and grandchildren will be denied the happy life that I've had, and which suddenly looks like fragile, improbable luck, luck that may now have run out. I feel gut-punched, like I've had the wind knocked out of me and may never get it back. I feel dread, hulking, lurking dread. Miguel is the sweet, sincere Mexican man who comes to clean our house once every 2 weeks. He's like family to us. When his younger daughter turned 15, we attended her quinceañera, an elaborate celebration in a hopeful little banquet hall in a shabby part of town. It probably cost him a few months' salary, and through the whole thing he ran around so nervously, trying to make sure everything went right and everyone had a good time, that he never sat down to relax and enjoy it himself. He's smart, hard-working, and selfless. If he'd been born into different circumstances, he'd be some kind of branch supervisor or district manager, conscientious and caring about everyone on his team. As it is, he cleans houses to make a better life for his daughters. The older one is in medical school, and when he talks about her future, he says, "That's the dream." I've never asked about his immigration status, but once he said, "Well, I did what I had to do for my family." Today, the morning after the election, when Miguel arrived at our house with his vacuum cleaner and his buckets, he looked like a ghost. I told him, "I'm so sorry," and he said, "We'll move to Canada." For me and my white friends, that's been the idle, joking threat, but for him, it's no joke. I walk past the Jack in the Box, the dry cleaner, the Walgreens that always has a couple of junkies and homeless guys in the parking lot. Miguel's kids, my kids. I think, how do we protect them? How did this happen? How could so many people make a choice that's so stupidly, unnecessarily, catastrophically wrong? How could they put the steering wheel of the world in the hands of this angry, drunk driver with all our kids in the back seat? Gullible, ignorant yahoos. How many years will it take before they slap their thick foreheads, do their remedial reading, and figure out that he's broken his ridiculous promises and broken our only world? Too late. Too late. And then comes another thought. These last several years, up till last night, I've been quietly celebrating humane, progressive change in our society, like almost everyone I know here in the blue bubble of Santa Monica. But all this time, out in the red states, Those same changes have made people fear for the future of their children, their grandchildren. I think they're wrong. In fact, I think they're backward and infuriatingly dim. I'll probably go on thinking it for the rest of this life, and they'll go on thinking I'm wrong. In our opinions, we'll remain irreconcilably divided, red and blue. But in our fear, we're one. Some newscaster last night cited a survey saying that half of Republicans are afraid of Democrats, and half of Democrats are afraid of Republicans. Gandhi said, "The enemy is fear. We think it is hate, but it is fear." Our fear divides us, but at the same time, it strangely unites us. Their fear feels to them just like mine does to me. Once again, different people, different circumstances, same feeling. Could there be some dark law of conservation of fear which dictates that there must be a constant amount of it at all times, that it's never destroyed but just batted like a tennis ball back and forth over the net of world affairs? Must we keep taking turns forever, being resentful and scared? Does this never end? Are we chronically, terminally screwed? I look to my left. In the western sky, shining above the ocean that I know is just a few blocks behind the car wash, I see the evening star, beautiful, brilliant Venus, named for the goddess of love. And as I do whenever I see her, I think of the Buddha and the story of his awakening. How, stricken by the universality of suffering, the chronic screwedness of human life, he left his father's palace, sought teachers, meditated, practiced austerities in the jungle, grew more frustrated, till finally he sat beneath a huge tree and vowed not to leave the spot till he found a solution, even if he had to sit till his blood and bones and flesh turned dry. After 49 days of struggle, after exhausting all his other moves, he finally stopped struggling. He let go and went into free fall, into what he had been all along, clear, simple, sublime, and, till that moment, somehow overlooked. Simple beingness itself, resting blissfully in itself. He gazed upon the morning star, as we call brilliant Venus when she rises in the east ahead of the sun, and he saw her as radiant as his own being was radiant, as all beings are radiant, even those not yet awake to their radiance. And he said, "How wonderful, how wonderful. All beings are enlightened just as they are." Thanks to what my teachers and my practice have shown me, I know that's true. I'm still in the process of awakening, not a full-grown Buddha yet, but I'm enough of a junior varsity Buddha to know I know this. Even if I don't see it clearly in every moment, steady and luminous as tonight's evening star, I've had enough glimpses to have faith in its presence all the time, even when it's clouded over by crappy events like a disastrous election or by my own cloudy vision. Not belief, but faith, confidence, the conviction that arises from experience and requires no belief. I'm like an infant that has finally attained object permanence, when it knows that the toy is still there even when mommy holds it behind her back. There's nothing to do but keep practicing. It's the same thing I said after 9/11 and the same thing I said when Maggie died. All our spiritual practice, all our meditative practice, these times when these catastrophes happen, are the times we've been practicing for. Of course, I also have to keep working on the earth plane, as effectively as I can see how, for the changes I think will make the best possible world for my grandchildren and all those red state grandchildren. But keep practicing to keep sharpening the vision of that star. and do the work I've stumbled into, which, through some incredible grace, is to help others see it. So, I have to get the car and go home and pack. I'm flying to Omaha in the morning to lead 3 days of meditation workshops. Shine my little light, deep in red country. Omaha. November 10th. Hotel room in Omaha. TV news. The president-elect meets the president in the White House. He sits on the edge of his seat, leaning forward awkwardly, unsure what to do with his hands, his eyes like saucers. And I realize he's terrified. Of course. He's in this boat of fear with the rest of us. Like us, he's a vulnerable, sentient being that has come unmoored from its own nature, frightened as it tosses on the waves, looking to land on something solid and sure. Now he's landed on what he thought would be the highest, driest rock in the world. But it won't help. He speaks some polite platitudes for the reporters, but his eyes say, "Oh, shit, what do I do now?" Divided in roles, united in fear. None of this changes what I need to do and say as a citizen. But as I take whatever action I take, I need to remember this. Remember and extend the tendrils of my compassion to him and you and all others to feel our commonality. Remember. And then I remember one more thing. My long-ago conversation with my prison group about that guy, as in everything would be fine if it weren't for that guy, and our conclusion that that guy, whoever he is in any moment, always brings you exactly the teaching you need, the seemingly intolerable situation that you must learn to be okay in the face of. That guy is always your guru, even this guy on the TV. When Ram Dass talks about his stroke, he says he was stroked by God. Okay, boss, bring it on. Chapter 35, The Magic Piano. Fun fact. On most pianos, the soundboard, the curved plank under the strings that amplifies their faint vibrations, is too short to resonate with the bottom octave. It's physically incapable of sounding those low notes down on the left end of the keyboard. Yet we hear them. How? Every note has overtones, a cloud of fainter, higher notes hovering above it and giving it color. The soundboard does vibrate the overtones for each missing low note, and when we hear them, our brain infers the note that should underlie them. Our neurons fire at the right frequency to produce the experience of the bass note that the piano doesn't make. No tree falls in the forest, but we're there to hear it, so it makes a sound. If the mind can make piano notes, what else might it be making? How much of the world we think we live in is just the world we think? It's as if we see concentric ripples spreading outward from a point on the surface of a pond, and we mentally create the pebble that should have been, must have been, wasn't tossed there. This is certainly true of many of our fear scenarios. One June, back in my high school teaching days, a just-graduated senior came to visit me at home. As I poured tea, he struggled for a good hour or more to come out to me. This was clearly as hard for him as walking through a wall, and I felt honored to be the one he felt safe with. But for years, the whole school had tacitly assumed he was gay. Everyone knew, and everyone knew that everyone knew except him. At last, he wrenched out his tearful confession. Then, as we talked about his years of sneaking and faking, it gradually sank in that he had spent his whole high school career worrying about revealing a dark secret that was a secret to no one. He'd been dancing his dance of dread to the overtones of a non-existent note. As he stood at the door to leave, he laughed and said, "Gee, Now I'll have to find something else to be neurotic about. As in this case, the more emotion we attach to the thing we imagine, the more real it seems. The energy of intense feeling fuels the brain's powers of magic conjuring, as successful salespeople and politicians know. Perhaps you've dreamed that you were in a heated argument with a friend, and when you woke up it took a minute to sort things out and convince yourself not to pick up the phone and yell at him. Or perhaps you've been convinced that your partner has thoughtlessly slighted you, and as you brooded on it you got more and more steamed till you finally spoke up and found out it was all a misunderstanding. Oddly, if that anger is strong enough, when the truth comes out, you may feel a little deflated. You've invested so much emotional energy in writing that scene, casting yourself as the noble injured party and your partner as the callous tormentor, that it's a letdown when the show is suddenly canceled. This is one reason that marriage is such a fine laboratory for awakening. You get so many opportunities to believe something passionately, only to have it flame out before your eyes, and then see what's left when the smoke clears. Fooled me again. Hopefully you and your partner have a good laugh and remember some of this for next time when the roles are reversed. The deepest note. After we've had enough such experiences, we may find ourselves led to a question. Could there be some fundamental false inference at the root of all our self-inflicted drama, some deepest silent piano note way down at the very end of the keyboard underlying all our crazy overtones, something that seems really, really real as it gets, deserving of all the emotional investment we can possibly give it, but which is ultimately as insubstantial as a dream? You already know the answer. If what we most deeply are is empty, open, mirror-like awareness, boundless like the sky, then we're not the separate, isolated self that we take ourselves to be. The separate self is the deepest false note, and it's where all the trouble starts. We've heard the sages' reports that the separate self, aka the person, has no substantial existence. It's not a thing, not a hunk of stuff. The word person comes from the Greek persona, mask, implying that it's not what we are, but something we look out through. Behind the mask, peeking out through the eye holes, what are we? If it's yet another person, another thing, then we'll have to ask what looks through its eye holes, and so forth, in an infinite regress of Russian dolls within dolls, an absurdity. That leaves the possibility that we're not a person or thing at all, not a hunk of stuff that has awareness, but awareness itself, open, formless, free. If that turns out to be true, confirmed by our own experience, then it changes everything. Then all the roles we've imagined for this person are just roles, roles to play while wearing our mask, overtones that imply the absent fundamental tone. They're things that we do, feel, think, but not what we are. So, you're not your name. You're not your family, your nationality, your culture, your religion. You're not a husband, wife, mother, father, son, daughter, brother, sister. You're not the team whose name is on your cap or T-shirt. You're not your income. You're not your place on the A-list, B-list, or Z-list. You're not your sex appeal. You're not your career. You're not your car. You're not your resume or your press release. You're not your diploma, even if it's from Harvard. You're not your neurosis. You're not your diagnosis. You're not your lifestyle. You're not your addiction or your sobriety. You're not a timeline. You're not a long story wending its way toward a happy or tragic ending. You're not your self-image or anybody else's image. You're not a race, gender, or age. You're not your personality. You're not your attitude. You're not your aesthetic gesture. You're not your thoughts, your words, your deeds, or their impact. You're not the summary bit of wisdom you imagine carved on your tombstone, or the first sentence you imagine in your Wikipedia article. The list could go on. At one time or another, you may have vaguely subscribed to most of these versions of what you might be. In the course of a day, you might rotate through several of them so seamlessly that you don't even realize you're rotating. Yet many of these definitions are mutually exclusive, so they can't all be true. Once we start imagining identities for ourselves, we can imagine anything. So what? Why does this matter? It matters because the separate self that you think you are is the one that suffers, the one to which fear, anger, anxiety, and craving stick. Because these roles are just big clusters of thoughts and feelings, it's easy for more feelings to stick to them. What you are is mirror-like awareness, to which nothing sticks. When you say, "I'm afraid," you're talking about the personal self. If it's really just a false inference, a will-o'-the-wisp, then there's no one there to suffer. In one deft yank, we've pulled the rug out from under all your afflictions. This doesn't mean we've gone all starry-eyed about life. There are still muggers and Mack trucks to dodge, flat tires on the freeway, and hay fever in the spring, and there always will be. Shit happens. But the personal self is the one that shit happens to. If it's a construct, then we can deconstruct it and abide as pure, open, aware space, and the stuff all goes right through us. The old texts say that, for the unawakened being, the traumas of life are like lines carved in rock. For the one who has awakened, they're like lines carved in water. And in fact, this is exactly what you've been practicing every time you sit to meditate. Your fundamental instruction is rest as awareness. Not just rest in awareness, not just be a person relaxing your grip and sinking gently into the silent ocean beneath the waves of thoughts, feelings, and sensations, but rest as awareness. Be, or rather, notice that you are and always have been the silent ocean. Gracious host to the waves, but never stirred by them. In time, that state of affairs spontaneously grows clear, both in and out of meditation. The A-B test. Here's one more way to play with this insight to help awaken during our non-meditating hours. For just one day, be on the alert and note what versions of the separate self you trot out to invest your identity in. Now I'm this role, I'm this body, I'm this hip attitude, I'm this sad or happy story. We're like a coach putting players in the game. Get in there, romantic melancholy, I know you can do it. Don't try to stop this process of identification, just observe it as clearly as you can. Note every time you define yourself, defend yourself, prop up yourself, inflate or deflate yourself, justify yourself. Note what all that feels like. Does it feel clear, mature, emotionally intelligent, or petty, or grandiose, or both? The next day, observe things in the same way, but don't be a self. Every time you observe yourself identifying with or propping up some version of personal selfhood, relax your grip on it. Frankie says, relax, don't do it. Unclench your grip and relax back into simple, open awareness. Anytime a temptation to justify or glorify the little self comes up, throw it into the fire and see what that feels like. Also, note how others respond when you come from this place of fresh openness. If necessary, keep alternating days like this till you get the point and see how icky separate selfhood feels. You'll probably notice that it's like eating big quantities of blue cotton candy. You remember it having delighted you once upon a time in a state of lesser maturity, but now it gives you a stomachache. Also, notice which makes you busier, being a separate self, or being free. At first, the old way may seem easier because you've had so much practice. It takes some vigilance to notice it and drop it, but that's only because the old habit is ingrained. Free, open awareness, to spin one more simile, is like a vast open plain, stretching on all sides to a clear horizon under a cloudless, sparkling sky. The separate self, with all its busy stories and gestures, is like an amusement park built over the plain. It has plenty of entertaining features, but it's a lot of work keeping them all going. The tilt-a-whirl, the haunted house, the hot dog stands, the games of skill with their crappy prizes. Let's face it, it's pretty sleazy. But I like the amusement park. Sure you do. It's amusing. But not to worry. Nobody's going to take it away from you. All that changes is that you're no longer a prisoner of it, no longer invested in the belief that you are it, no longer stuck with its endless maintenance. Being a person is hard work. Being being is no work. You relax as the open plain, rest as awareness, and it becomes clearer and clearer that the park runs itself. With greater maturity of consciousness, you may lose interest in a few of the rides. Maybe you don't really need to go through the haunted house a 10,000th time. Then they fade away like a dream, which is what they've been all along. Chapter 36. Lord Shiva Kicks Ass. Let's talk about loss. When you're hit by loss, you lose your job, you lose your spouse, you lose your health, you lose your cherished dream, it can be devastating. You can feel as if things have gone so utterly and hopelessly wrong that they'll never be right again. You can feel that the good times, the happy times, are now past, never to be revived, that joy has gone out of your life for good. If you're lucky, you have people around to encourage you, to reassure you that things will get better. It's all very sweet and sincere. You don't need me to be one more hopeful voice. Instead, let's pause for a moment and listen to the voice that we try to ignore, the one that says, hey, maybe things won't get better. And maybe they won't. Maybe you won't get a new job, recoup the value of your 401k, or save your house from the repo man. Maybe your beloved country won't be rescued from the thugs who've seized power. Maybe you won't find a new partner who's sweet and understanding. Maybe you won't find a new partner at all. We don't know what you'll find. We do know what you'll lose. Everything, sooner or later. On the day you die, if not before, you'll lose your partner, your job, your car, your house, your money, your country, your family, your body, and your mind. It's always been this way, and always will. Only rare, lovely little islands of relative comfort and tranquility distract us from this fundamental human predicament. One such island was enjoyed for the last several decades by Americans with enough money and the right complexion. But every island eventually fades over the horizon, and then we're back in this same leaking boat, bailing water as fast as we can. Yet a few people, Christ, Buddha, Al-Halaj, Shankara, and assorted other sages, remain unperturbed. All along they've told us not to invest our happiness in the impermanent. Just before his death, the Buddha said, all constructed things must deconstruct. He wasn't just warning us not to make some shaky startup dreamer or Ponzi schemer the captain of our souls, or pointing out that every marriage ends in divorce or death. He was going more hardcore than that, anticipating the second law of thermodynamics, which describes how, over time, the neat arrangements of molecules that make up our universe must inevitably fly apart into messy chaos. Everything that's been put together, your house, your body, the Mona Lisa, your favorite shirt, your favorite planet, must eventually fall apart. Someday, as Charlton Heston discovers in Planet of the Apes, the Statue of Liberty will be just a bit of wreckage on the beach. It's pure, inescapable physics. So, why are the sages unperturbed? What can we learn from them? In the face of universal destruction, how can we fear less? In 1688, the wealthy samurai poet Masahide lost all his possessions when his storage barn was destroyed in a fire. He responded by writing a haiku. Barns burnt down. Now I can see the moon. We build up our career and our marriage. We store our treasures in our barn or in our stock portfolio or on our hard drive, and then they consume our attention. When they crash, it's a time of pain. But it can also be a time of vision. It's an opportunity to notice the underlying luminous nature of existence itself, Masahide's moon, which has been there all along. When everything that's material dematerializes, when everything perishable perishes, it's a chance to see what's immaterial and imperishable. 300 years after Masahide, a famous actor lost his Malibu house in a fire and commented, "It was so liberating." 12 years after the Monica Lewinsky scandal, Bill Clinton told an interviewer, "Once you've been publicly humiliated like I was, it doesn't much matter what people ever say about you again for the rest of your life. And it's kind of liberating." The Buddha spoke one more sentence before he died. "Through diligent seeing, be liberated." Jesus said, "Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal." Clearly, all our earthly treasures are doomed to slip through our fingers. But what are treasures in heaven? This heaven business can sound like some fairy tale, Sunday school, Hollywood ending to our tragedy of loss, some opium of the people, pie in the sky when you die, until we remember that Jesus himself stated clearly that the kingdom of heaven is not on some post-mortem cloud, but within you. He's even more to the point in the Gospel of Thomas, one of the Gospels that didn't make the cut. Its teachings are so radical that it was buried in the sand and not recovered till 1945. There he says, "The kingdom of the Father is spread out upon the earth, and people don't see it." That kingdom, that luminous reality, the essential liberative radiance of just being, is what we're walking around in right now. If we can relax and pay attention to it for even a moment, if we can just take a break from being hypnotized by our usual compulsive accumulation, that luminosity starts, even if only faintly, to come into focus. And if you make that attention a habit, the focus becomes clearer and clearer. After Maggie and I finished raising our kids, we downsized and bought the charming little Tudor cottage of our dreams. She supervised some tasteful remodeling. I hauled in our books. We set up the grill on the patio and the cushions in the meditation room. The month we moved in, she was diagnosed with terminal cancer. That night, I drove home from the hospital to the new house, which I could now barely stand to look at, sat on the front lawn, and howled and wept into the sky. She died 6 months later, and the life together that we had imagined was gone. The months after that were hard. The first time the reality of her goneness really hit me was at the A&P, when I found myself grocery shopping for one. I soon stopped going to that store. They always seemed to be piping in tragic love songs. I'd be picking out lettuce or bananas, and it would take all the willpower I could summon to make it out of the produce section without collapsing in tears. But there was also something very precious about that time. The burning of that barn of imagination showed me the luminous moon of actuality. Where our marriage had been, there was now an empty space that I could have called loneliness or desolation. But I didn't call it anything, and by leaving it unlabeled, I could experience it as just space. And in that, there was great liberation. It helped that I had years of meditation under my belt. After she died, I wrote a haiku of my own. My heart is broken. Open. Maggie had years of practice and view under her belt as well. Once she looked up from her hospital bed and asked me, "How do people who don't meditate deal with this?" I shrugged. "I don't know." Her dying was her final exam, and she got an A. 2 weeks or so before she passed, a friend called, excited, offering to bring some Tibetan monks to her room to do some special chanting for her. She said, "No, that wouldn't be authentic for me. That hasn't been my practice. My practice is just being without hope or fear." That's a steep teaching. Everyone wants to get rid of fear and hold on to hope. Keep hope alive, we tell each other and ourselves. We can make that work up to a point, but finally we have to recognize that fear is hope's flip side. They're both ways of betting our happiness on a particular outcome, of requiring that outcome for life to be okay. We can't invest our happiness in the hope of winning the game, the lottery, the election, without buying the corresponding fear of losing. But what if we let go of both hope and fear? What would that be like? How would that freedom taste? And if that freedom sounds enticing, why wait till cancer or some other inescapable catastrophe pushes you to the wall before you open to it? Consider the wind. The wind is nature's gardener, expertly pruning the trees. Every leaf falls exactly on time. Anything that can shake off will shake off, and to the extent that there's such a thing as should, it should shake off. The tree also falls exactly on time. The only thing that makes any of this tragic is our concept of the tree as something with just those leaves in just those places forever. That has never happened with anything for anyone anywhere. Persistence in the illusion of things or people or situations that will eternally conform to our preferences is a definition of immaturity and a recipe for anguish. When you choose maturity, you choose to spare yourself that agony. In the Hindu Trinity, Brahma is the creator, Vishnu the preserver, and Shiva the dissolver. Everything goes through the cycle of creation, preservation, dissolution. The budding, blossoming, and withering of a flower, the rise, peak, and fall of a civilization, the emergence, evolution, and destruction of a galaxy. The last phase is always just as necessary and right as the other two. Lord Shiva is the last one out of the building, the one who turns off the lights, the one who rings down the curtain and writes, "The end." By embracing him, we undercut our own ability to cry, "Wait, no, this is a mistake." In every cycle of existence, dissolution is the phase that's most conducive to awakening. In fact, Shiva is also the liberator. He turns off the lights, but he turns on the light. Dissolution sounds a lot like disillusion. And that, as the saying goes, is too much of a coincidence to be a coincidence. Usually we think of disillusionment as a bad thing. But why is being relieved of illusions bad? It's all Lord Shiva kicking our ass, kicking over our meticulously constructed castles of sand, mercifully kicking us awake from our dreams of endless empires and Ponzi economies and frozen effigies of our lovers, kicking us awake to the clear light of being, of awareness, now. Yes, it's true that the death of what we have known and loved best feels like the end of the world. But it's also true that the liberation that offers itself to us in that tender, vulnerable time of loss is proportional to our devastation. At the end of the world, Lord Shiva dances. His kicking is part of his dance, and as he dances, he holds up his right hand, palm forward, in the Abhaya Mudra, the universal gesture that means, be at peace, all is well, fear not. Chapter 37. Fear of the Lord. The comedian Adam Ferrara summarizes his Catholic upbringing in four words. Stretching out his arms like Jesus on the cross, his eyes glaring with reproach, he snaps, I'm dead, your fault. But Catholics don't have a monopoly on spirituality served up with a couple of big scoops of guilt, shame, and/or fear. The school in New Jersey where I used to teach was founded in the 19th century by a Presbyterian minister, the Reverend Dr. John F. Pingree. Upstairs in the library, where generations of pubescent scholars have studied French, chemistry, and the cutie at the next table, hangs a large, heavily varnished oak plank, inscribed with Dr. Pingree's motto from the Book of Psalms. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Cheers, everyone! I remember a skeptical science teacher once rolling his eyes at the plank and quietly sharing his own theory of religion. The fear of wisdom is the beginning of the Lord. Just for the record, there's also a block of granite behind the building inscribed, Dr. Pingree used to stand on this stone to mount his horse. Westerners who turn to Eastern religions to escape fear-based spirituality are sometimes dismayed to discover that Hinduism and Buddhism, at least in their most old-school forms, have not just one but dozens of hell realms, as painstakingly customized as anything dreamed up by Dante. Commit certain sexual infractions, and you can wind up dog paddling in a river of semen, feces, and animal guts. Namaste! In some of the old pictures of these creative torture salons, the punishments are carried out by horned, bat-winged devils that look all too familiar to Westerners. At least these hells are not eternal. You spend a few eons there till you burn off your bad karma, then come back to the human realm to give it another try. Judaism is probably the religion that has dodged these terrors most successfully just by being vague. Ask the next five Jews you meet what their religion teaches about the afterlife, and you'll probably get five shrugs. But even if you don't subscribe to any hellfire scenarios, you may still be affected by them in ways you don't realize. The Protestants who founded American society believed that worldly success was a sign that you were among God's elect. The poor, after a lifetime of deprivation, could look forward to an eternity in hell. And it was embarrassingly obvious to all the neighbors who the once-and-future losers were. This is the historical root of our famous Protestant work ethic. Our compulsive busyness is driven by shame and fear. Fear was injected even deeper into our legacy during the First Great Awakening, the revival movement that transformed colonial-era church services from solemn, tedious rituals to get-down doomsday sermonizing. It was so effective at scaring the bejesus into people that congregants would weep, writhe, or faint, and in some cases, commit suicide. One of the most prominent preachers of the era was Jonathan Edwards, known for such sermons as his 1741 greatest hit, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as worthy of nothing else but to be cast into the fire. God will be so far from pitying you when you cry to him that 'tis said he will only laugh and mock. Certainly, this kind of punitive God is useful for crowd control. When you're trying to form a coherent society in a wilderness, whether it's the deserts of the Sinai or the forests of the New World, a scary God keeps us in line so we can live side by side without killing anyone, except witches and Indians. That kind of religion requires ritual as well as hierarchy, so we can practice obedience. Make your request in the prescribed way, take 2 steps to the left, don't ask for bread, and if you screw it up, God shouts, "No grace for you!" These days, thankfully, the soup Nazi God has yielded much of the stage to a kinder, gentler God, with kinder, gentler devotees. We have contemporary religious commentators like Kimberly Winston, who has written, "If the concept of God has any use, it is to make us larger, freer, and more loving. If God can't do that, it's time we got rid of him." There's plenty of material to support both views. Some revisionist interpreters nowadays even spin the words "fear of the Lord" as "awe of the Lord" or "reverence for the Lord." That goes down a lot easier. But unfortunately, the original Hebrew word, yirat, clearly means fear. And, right or wrong, the Hellfire guys were the fathers of our country. They're in our national DNA. Jonathan Edwards had 11 children, and his descendants included 13 college presidents, each in a position to influence the thinking of thousands. Even if you feel personally immune to this stuff, it echoes in our cultural memory. It's worth trying to sort it out. So, is God a mean guy, justifying your worst fears? Or a nice guy, another good reason to relax? Is God a stern parent? When your father gets home, you're in big trouble. Or a soft, pliable parent? Time for cookies and milk. Most religions offer, in some form, both of those answers, because both modes of being are so basic to human life. Some offer way more than 2. The answers in Hinduism, like everything in Hinduism, are especially rich and varied. There are dozens of mother goddesses alone, from gentle, nurturing Lakshmi, who stands on a lotus floating on a tranquil lake with gold coins pouring out of her hand, to fierce Kali Ma, with wild hair, ferocious eyes, and protruding tongue, wielding fearsome weapons, clothed in severed arms and heads. Sometimes we need a fierce mom to protect us. But wait, there's something wrong with this whole line of questioning. We've already discovered that when we look for the person that we allegedly are, the daughter, the salesman, the jokester, the seeker, it deconstructs before our eyes. What's left in its place is awareness, beingness, conscious open space without boundaries. So, is God a cuddly person or a prickly person? None of the above. If little old me is non-personal boundlessness, certainly great big God must be non-personal boundlessness as well. The personal God is the projection of the personal separate self. It's what infinity looks like when you look as a person. When we look up at God, or look up for God, as long as we're looking through the distorting lens of the person we think we are, we'll see a person. Once we remove that lens, the sky above us is clear. There's no one up there to fear, and no one down here to fear him. Thus our pictures of God, who warns us in the commandments not to picture him, may really be selfies, images of the self we think we are, with all its charming and alarming traits, projected onto a giant screen in the sky, where we can view them more clearly, watch them collectively, and see how they play out. In that sense, religions are like epic superhero movies. If the film is going to sell tickets, the protagonist must be both man, ordinary, moody, Clark Kentish, so we can identify with him, and super, so he can take us to infinity and beyond. These movies can be inspiring, terrifying, or baffling to express the full spectrum of human life in all its most inspiring, terrifying, and baffling aspects. But it may be time to cull our playlist. Once upon a time, the horror movie god, the Freddy Krueger god, could do only limited damage. But now that we have drones, computers, and WMDs to carry out his will, he threatens our survival. Again, here's Adam Ferrara, ranting in a sarcastic snarl that sounds somewhere between Jackie Gleason and Bugs Bunny. God's gonna get us all killed. Terrorists convince thousands of people to kill themselves in the name of God. I can't convince two of my friends to help me move. And I think human arrogance will be the demise of civilization. Look, if you think God is talking to you, and you understand God, and God needs you to kill somebody else for him, if that's what you truly feel, just sit down till that feeling goes away. 'Cause I'm fairly certain if God wants somebody dead, that guy is dead, okay? He don't need you. He's got the key to the lightning cabinet. So just settle down, you arrogant, finite, carbon-based life form. No one can tell you what to think or feel or do about God. But I think most of us can agree it's time to kiss the old divine boogeyman goodbye and good riddance. No eternal tormentor to inspire our fear, no righteous warrior to justify our anger, no masturbation monitor to ensure our anxiety. But where do we go from there? Some people will go with no God, above us only sky, as John Lennon sang in Imagine. Some will go with a loving God, perhaps with wonderful results. I have evangelical Christian friends whose good works in saving African children from starvation put my laziness to shame. But there's another possibility. You've heard it, but you may not have heard it. God is love. Not loving. This is not just the angry old man in the sky upgraded to a mellow old man in the sky. God is love, not someone or something that loves. But how can God be a human emotion, a feeling? It can't. We cited earlier these words from Rupert Spira. Love is not a feeling. It's lack of an other, of otherness. We'll be exploring this notion further. But for now, if there's something that speaks to you in these two assertions, that God is love and love is non-otherness, perhaps just let them float gently somewhere inside you. Don't necessarily even think about them. Just let them mix in the test tube of your heart and see what chemical reaction takes place. It might turn out that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but only the beginning. The end of wisdom, the goal, the culmination, the end point, the end of the story, might be love. Chapter 38. Valley of the Shadow. I was scared to death of death. I was 7 years old when I realized I was going to die. I was going to die. This was not an encyclopedia topic. This was not a school report. This was not those hungry children in Africa guilting me into cleaning my plate. This was not cowboys on Gunsmoke or pioneers on Wagon Train, clutching their strangely bloodless gunshot wounds, going limp, and now a word from our sponsor. This was Dean, me. This kid right here, sweating in my bed, imagining a forgotten grave under a lonely tree, with oblivious strangers strolling 6 feet above my head as if I had never existed. forever. My parents were more or less atheists with no spiritual reassurance to offer. Eventually, I saw that as a blessing, as it spurred my search and left me free to embark on it without a lot of baggage. But that was later. And a religious rationale might not have helped anyway. I also learned later that even the people who believe that they believe in some kind of heaven in the sky will often force-march their poor, spent bodies through every last-ditch medical intervention. I think most people, regardless of their alleged creed, are haunted by the same fear that gripped me at 7. To get through the day not paralyzed by that fear, we've perfected the art of looking away from it, just as we look away from the glare of the sun so habitually that we forget we're doing it. That's a glaring omission. If we're going to deal with this thing, we at least have to acknowledge it. Once, in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, I saw a seagull swoop overhead on its way from the ocean to a nearby grove with a big fish wriggling desperately in its beak. I wondered if, and hoped that, for at least one moment, as the fish soared through that incomprehensibly wide-open dimension of sky, it looked around and thought, "Wow, I'm flying far out." When our culture does consider death, it often gets things wrong, sometimes spectacularly wrong, as in Dylan Thomas's "Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night," in which he urges his dying father to furiously resist what he calls the dying of the light. This is good, rousing poetry, but it's very bad advice. This is calling for courage rather than serenity to address the one thing we definitely can't change. Talk about using the wrong tool for the job. Talk about flunking the final exam. We can file this poem under swaggering obstinacy, along with that damned Invictus. My head is bloody but unbowed. Yeah, that's what happens when you keep slamming your head into things. Slamming your head into things also keeps you from seeing clearly. When we finally relax out of those doomed heroics and pay attention, we have a chance to see what the sages saw, the reality that let them face death without fear, rage, evasion, or macho posturing. The light does not die. Whatever dies is not the light. You are not what dies. You are the light of the world, the light of awareness, which shines for a time through this form, this person, like light shining through a window, and does not cease shining when the window breaks. Unlike our poets, you know this firsthand. You've experienced it many times. Every time you meditate, you're rehearsing for the time of dying. The world dissolves, the body dissolves, the senses and their objects dissolve. Thinking and emoting and behaving dissolve. Space and time dissolve. You relax your grip, everything dissolves, and you find out that when everything dissolves, there's nothing to fear. Everything dissolves. All the objects that have been dancing in the light, including the body, leaving only you, the awareness, the light. Notice that I said time of dying, not time of death. There's no such thing as an experience of death. It's not an experienceable reality. Death is a concept that can only be conceived by the living. When they say, "Bob's been dead for 6 years," they're applying the concept of time to the absence of Bob's body from this world. That makes sense from their point of view. But from Bob's point of view, when he dies, time dissolves, the world dissolves, the body dissolves, and Bob, the person concept he thought he was for a while, dissolves. All dissolve into timeless, worldless, bodiless, Bobless awareness. This is the confusion I labored under as I tossed and turned at age 7. I was imagining Dean's death from the point of view of Dean living. The years and years, time, of lying 6 feet, space, under the earth, world, hold terrors only for the one thinking about it, mind. It has nothing to do with one who has dropped out of time, space, world, and mind. Thus, the great fear, as expressed in Psalm 23, is not the valley of death, but the valley of the